last investigator I chatted with was Dr. Sarah Hurvitz, who last fall presented the randomized phase 2 trial of T-DM1 at the ECHO-ESMO meeting in Stockholm. And to begin our conversation, I also asked Dr. Hurvitz to present a couple of her cases. And to begin, she commented on a woman who participated in the trial.
So I had this lovely 43-year-old woman who came to me with shortness of breath. And her story was that about a year earlier, she had been diagnosed with stage 3 ERPR negative, HER2 positive breast cancer, underwent a modified radical mastectomy. And as soon as the surgeon told her, you need to have radiation therapy, chemotherapy, and trastuzumab, she bolted. She went and did alternative therapies. She believed if she strengthened her immune system, she wouldn't require these systemic therapies. And she came back a year later with back pain and shortness of breath. So we worked her up. We biopsied the lung nodule. It was non-diagnostic, but given the short disease-free interval, it was pretty suggestive on scans that she had a metastatic recurrence. And so we enrolled her on the TDM-4450 study, which is a phase 2 randomized study, the results of which were just presented in ESMO, that looked at docetaxel trastuzumab and compared it to T-DM1. And she was assigned to the control arm. So she went on to the docetaxel trastuzumab. She had a beautiful response, a complete response in all of the soft tissue masses and nodules, but stable disease in her bone lesions. And then went on to single agent trastuzumab, you know, dropped off the docetaxel because she developed some neuropathy, did quite well, but 18 months after going on study, she had progressive disease. And this phase 2 randomized study allowed crossover to the study arm, so she was allowed to cross over to T-DM1. About a week after she crossed over to T-DM1, she complained of a mild headache, which was really just an incidental complaint. But because of the propensity of HER2-positive breast cancer to go to the brain and the lack of CNS penetration by trastuzumab, I ordered an MRI of the brain, and she had a solitary cerebellar metastasis that probably wasn't even the cause of her headache. Because it had been diagnosed a week after going on to T-DM1, our IRB agreed that this was there prior to her going on T-DM1 and granted an exception for her to receive stereotactic radiosurgery to the brain and continue on the T-DM1, which is exactly what she did. And to date, she is doing beautifully. She's had resolution of the brain metastasis with the stereotactic radiosurgery. She's tolerating the T-DM1 beautifully for the last 5 or 6 months. Her hair is, you know, a full head of hair. She's having virtually no side effects. One day of mild nausea after the T-DM1 infusion. And so I just thought this was a nice case to highlight the data.
And there are a lot of really interesting points to the data. Can you just talk a little bit about what you presented there?
So this was a phase 2 study that enrolled 137 patients with HER2-positive metastatic breast cancer, previously untreated. Patients were randomized to the trastuzumab docetaxel versus T-DM1. The docetaxel was allowed to be 75 milligrams per meter square or 100. About 75% of the investigators chose the 75 dose. The primary endpoint of the study was progression-free survival. Interestingly, only 27% of the patients had received trastuzumab in the adjuvant setting in the control arm and 18% in the study arm, which was a point raised by many people after the presentation. So the progression-free survival in the T-DM1 arm was 14.2 months, which was 5 months higher than that in the trastuzumab docetaxel arm. It was associated with a 41% relative risk reduction for progression-free survival, which was statistically significant. And the objective response rates and clinical benefit rates were similar between the two groups. What was kind of interesting is that the median duration of treatment in the docetaxel arm was 5.5 months for docetaxel itself and 10 months for TDM1. So what that tells us is the tolerability of docetaxel compared to TDM1 is different. And the patients were able to stay on TDM1 because of its targeted delivery of the chemotherapy to the cancer cells much longer than they were able to continue on the chemotherapy that's not targeted, docetaxel. What was really profoundly important in this presentation or in this study is the difference in adverse events between the two arms. And Edith Perez presented at ESMO 2010 the early AE rates. Well, the AE rates that we presented in September of 2011 was that 89% of the patients in the docetaxel trastuzumab arm had an adverse event, grade 3 adverse event, only 46% in the TDM1 arm. So that's a huge difference. If you look at SAEs, they were higher with the control arm. AEs leading to treatment discontinuation, 7% versus 29%. So it was just a much better tolerated therapy. And the vast majority of patients, 97% of patients on TDM1, did not lose their hair, which is a huge clinical endpoint from a patient's perspective.
Maybe you can talk a little bit about this agent, you know, what it is essentially and how it's thought to work. And I mean, really, when you say 47% grade 3 adverse events, I kind of wonder if people are sitting back saying, well, what? Because supposedly it doesn't have very many adverse events.
Right. So to answer your first question, TDM1 is trastuzumab that is linked to a derivative of maytansine. Maytansine, as you may recall, is an incredibly cytotoxic chemotherapy that was actually shelved, I believe, in the 80s because of its toxicity profile. And the magic in TDM1 is that thioether linker molecule that does not release the maytansine until it is inside the tumor cell. So this is a point of clarification because I've seen a lot of people talk about TDM1 releasing the chemo when it's in the vicinity of the tumor cell, but it actually has to be internalized within the tumor cell for the linker to release the maytansine. So the trastuzumab binds to the HER2 receptor. It does its thing. It has its own activity. The trastuzumab maintains its anti-tumor activity. It's then internalized. The linker is cleaved, I believe inside of a lysosome, and the maytansine is able to be activated. So this is truly targeted delivery of chemo. Now, I was a fellow when we were looking at drugs and treating patients with other ADCs, such as Mylotarg, and the toxicity was horrendous because the linker released the chemotherapy willy-nilly. So really, although there have been other ADCs before TDM1, I think this is the first one that's truly successful in the way that it delivers the chemotherapy. In terms of the adverse events experienced in patients who are treated with TDM1, the most common ones are fatigue and nausea. Some patients have an elevation in their AST or ALT. And then this other issue of thrombocytopenia, which is being looked into but not completely understood at this point. The all-grade thrombocytopenia was higher for TDM1 than in the control arm. So the incidence of grade 3-4 thrombocytopenia was about 9% in the TDM1 arm, about 3% in the trastuzumab docetaxel arm. But there were no grade 3-4 hemorrhagic events for TDM1. There was a grade 2 event, I believe. So in general, it's very well tolerated, although there were enough AEs in the grade 3 range to bring that number up to 46%.
So one more question about TDM1. What do you think the reason is of the apparent improved efficacy? Granted, it's a phase 2. Do you think that there's a reason to think that the anti-tumor effect itself might be greater than, say, trastuzumab chemo? Or do you think it's more what you were saying before, they can stay on treatment longer because it's better tolerated?
Well, I think that the duration of treatment is an important reason why patients have more efficacy because the response rates are similar between the two treatment arms. So I do think that duration of treatment is important and may be a big reason why it outrun docetaxel trastuzumab. However, that said, you know, the maytansine drug is incredibly potent. It's more potent than vincristine or paclitaxel. So it could be that we're just able, because of the technology, to use a very highly potent chemotherapy and get it to the cancer cells. The Amelia study, which completed enrollment at the end of 2011, should have data available this year. And that's the phase 3 study evaluating this molecule. And so I think we'll be able to see a little bit better what truly the efficacy is, although the control arm in that study is lapatinib capecitabine, which is a little bit of a different question.
That is interesting. So we'll see what happens with that. But, you know, oncologists hear cases like the one you just described, I think, are saying, you know, what am I going to do when this gets available? When is it going to be available? But now there's another thing out on the table, which is suddenly, as a result of San Antonio in December, pertuzumab, the Cleopatra study. Can you briefly comment on that and maybe speculate about, you know, how we're going to be treating HER2-positive metastatic disease in a year or two?
Yes, you bring up a good point, and I tell my nurse practitioner with whom I work very closely, I just love treating HER2-positive disease because there are so many therapies available. Unfortunately, it's the minority of patients. The Cleopatra data was very interesting. This is evaluating pertuzumab, which is, again, a humanized monoclonal antibody that binds to HER2 at an epitope that's different than where trastuzumab binds, and because of its binding site, is able to prevent HER2 from dimerizing with other ligand-activated HER receptors. So because they bind to different sites, they have potentially complementary mechanisms of action. There is preclinical data that suggested they work well together. So this study enrolled 808 patients with HER2-positive metastatic breast cancer, and they were assigned to receive either trastuzumab docetaxel or pertuzumab trastuzumab docetaxel. It's interesting that in this study, because not all studies have this, 95% of the patients in this study had HER2 FISH positive disease. So it was a really clean data set, it looked like. And what is also interesting, because with the TDM-4450 study, there was a lot of talk about the low number of patients who had received prior trastuzumab in the adjuvant setting. In this study, it should be noted that only about 10% of patients had received prior trastuzumab. So I found that really interesting when I was looking at the data.
What do you think this means? Do you see it as in any way compromising the clinical applicability of the findings?
It's a good question. It doesn't tell us really how it relates to patients who've had a short disease-free interval after trastuzumab-based therapy. In other words, we really don't know whether it's going to have that same sort of profound benefit. My guess is it would, that it would still beat trastuzumab docetaxel alone by adding another HER2-targeted agent in the face of trastuzumab resistance. But it doesn't address that. I think the problem with these studies, or the issue with these studies, not necessarily a problem, is that the majority of patients enrolled were ex-US and didn't have access to trastuzumab the same way that it was granted access in the United States. So that's just something that we're going to have to deal with. I don't think it's going to stop anyone from using it, but I think that we're going to have to follow the data as it comes out in the coming years that looks more at patients who have been trastuzumab pretreated. I mean, only half of patients in this study had received any adjuvant or neoadjuvant therapy. So it's just a different sort of patient population than we are really seeing in the United States. I don't think that it devalues the data in a major way, but it's something that needs to be kept in mind.
So maybe thinking about a situation in the future, and maybe it's not going to be that long from now if it happens, where both TDM1 and pertuzumab are available to people in practice, how do you see people using those?
It depends on what the Amelia trial shows. Amelia is enrolling patients who have been treated with trastuzumab. They're more like your second-line patients. And so if that trial is positive, then you've got Cleopatra in the first-line setting. the rational thing would be to use pertuzumab, trastuzumab-based therapy in the first-line setting, and T-DM1 in the resistant setting. That doesn't mean that biologically there's no reason to use T-DM1 up front. I'm a huge proponent of T-DM1 because with T-DM1, the chemo is with the antibody, and the toxicity is very low. With pertuzumab, you're still faced with needing to add chemotherapy to it. If you remember the Neosphere data looking at the pertuzumab and trastuzumab and the combination pathologic complete response rates, pretty low. You really do need the chemotherapy still with that.
Of course, that was a neoadjuvant therapy.
Certainly was. You're right. But it just sort of speaks to the activity of the molecule as a single agent. You still need the chemotherapy.
So I'm thinking about oncologists driving along the roads of America saying, how about T-DM1 and pertuzumab?
Sounds like a great idea. The Marianne study is actually a phase 3 study right now that is looking at T-DM1 with or without pertuzumab versus trastuzumab and a taxane for the first line treatment of HER2-positive metastatic breast cancer. So now you've got kind of your three big agents being evaluated in the first line metastatic breast cancer setting. I believe that study is still enrolling, so it'll be some time before we have data from that. And then there are a bunch of groups, ourselves included, that are putting forth ideas and concepts for development of adjuvant and neoadjuvant studies looking at T-DM1 and combined with pertuzumab in that setting. And the wonderful thing is that you can kind of envision almost a chemotherapy-free future for these women potentially, or for select women, if the data are as impressive as we've seen so far.
People are always correcting me when I, you know, kind of refer to T-DM1 as a non-chemo. I mean, technically it does have chemo, but it kind of seems like it's not.
Right, right.
So actually, when you think about San Antonio, there's a lot of stuff that is really relevant to practice or maybe is going to be relevant. And the other item that, you know, might be an issue in a patient with HER2-positive metastatic disease and is definitely going to be an issue in HER2-negative ER-positive disease are mTOR inhibitors. Now, I know you had a case of a patient on the so-called BOLERO-1 study. Rather than getting into the case, maybe you can just kind of clarify a little bit about mTOR inhibitors, BOLERO-1 and HER2-positive disease that we don't have results for, and then again, BOLERO-2 that was just presented.
So everolimus, which I used to know as RAD001, is an mTOR complex 1 inhibitor. So if you envision the HER2 activating the AKT-PI3 kinase mTOR pathway, this pathway has been shown to be activated in trastuzumab-resistant disease. A number of groups have shown data preclinically and through neoadjuvant studies that this appears to be a mechanism of resistance to trastuzumab. It also appears to be a mechanism of endocrine resistance and activation of this pathway. And there appears to be a very close interaction between mTOR signaling and ER signaling. And so preclinical models seem to suggest that targeting mTOR, the endpoint of this pathway, or one of the endpoints, may improve or get around trastuzumab resistance in HER2-positive disease and endocrine resistance in ER-positive disease. Our laboratory, we actually have 51 breast cancer cell lines that are fully annotated that sort of reflect the heterogeneous nature of breast cancer. And several years ago, we ran RAD001 through the breast cancer cell lines. And what came out of our data is that the luminal subtypes and the HER2 subtypes tend to have the greatest response or the best IC50s with RAD001. And really, the basal subtypes don't appear to benefit at all from everolimus. And this is single agent data. About 60% of the HER2 positive cell lines improved or had a good IC50 demonstrating sensitivity to RAD001, and greater than 2/3 of the ER positive or luminal subtypes demonstrated sensitivity. So data like this came out by ours and other groups, and a decision to clinically explore everolimus in these two subsets. For the HER2 positive, that's where I've been more involved. We did a phase one study that was published in JCO. Fabrice Andre was the first author, and I was senior last year, looking at everolimus combined with paclitaxel and trastuzumab in heavily refractory HER2 positive metastatic breast cancer. There were 33 patients treated, 97% were trastuzumab resistant, 94% had received prior taxanes, and about half of them had had prior lapatinib and had progressed. And we saw an objective response rate of about 44%, which was impressive in this group. So it went through phase two testing and ultimately phase three testing, which is the BOLERO-1 study, which is first-line HER2-positive metastatic breast cancer. Patients are randomly assigned in a 2-to-1 ratio to receive either paclitaxel trastuzumab everolimus or paclitaxel trastuzumab placebo. Over 700 patients enrolled, and the enrollment to this study closed at the end of 2011, so we're expecting or hoping for results toward the end of 2012 from the first analysis.
Could I just ask you, in terms of your own experience, I mean, oncologists, I think, have some exposure to everolimus through renal cell cancer. But, I mean, for example, this 62-year-old lady who was in the trial, now you don't know what she was on, but did she have mucositis? I mean, you think you can tell who gets the drug?
Yes, this question of, is there truly a way to blind oncologists and patients to what treatment they're receiving is an important one, because I think you can tell. I see more nosebleeds in my patients on everolimus. The mucositis, after the first week of my patient receiving everolimus or placebo, she had a sore on her tongue. Thereafter, she took the pill and a dollop of whipped cream and has not had the stomatitis occur again, because that sore was so pronounced and painful to her. She wanted to avoid it and read up, and we discussed ways to avoid it. And there are some anecdotes that putting the pill in a dollop of whipped cream or sour cream will help it go down easier and protect the mucosa.
Hold on, before you go away for that, I always love those little anecdotes. If that's true, would that suggest that somehow the pill has a direct effect on the mucus?
It would, doesn't it?
It's weird.
In fact, at our investigator meetings, we started telling the coordinators and investigators this little trick to try and get around it. You know, so I think you can figure out who is on and who is not receiving it. And the other thing is that I had 5 patients on this study, and anecdotally had several patients experience dyspnea and a couple patients with frank pneumonitis. Now, the numbers are low from the published literature, but it is something that you watch out for, and I think that's an early clue. Although paclitaxel and trastuzumab are associated with pneumonitis as well, the fact that these patients developed it made me a little bit convinced that they were receiving the real drug.
Incidentally, when do you typically see it after treatment started?
It can happen at any point. Personally, it wasn't immediate for my patients. It was several months into therapy. It improves with holding therapy and with steroids. One patient, I actually had to give steroids and had her see a pulmonologist. She had underlying interstitial lung disease from smoking, and probably what's a newly diagnosed scleroderma was also affecting her, but usually is several months into therapy. So you have to have a high index of suspicion. You have to be aware of the condition and not treat the patient just with antibiotics for pneumonia. You have to check PFTs, and when in question or when in doubt, send the patient to a pulmonologist for assistance.
So we may be looking at everolimus adding into the mix with pertuzumab and TDM1 and HER2 positive disease. I want to ask you about it in HER2 negative, specifically ER positive disease. But one more issue that you had mentioned in your write-up, which is the issue of blood-brain barrier and everolimus.
Yes. So actually, one of the patients in the phase one study that I described with everolimus had a brain metastasis that had grown back after surgery and radiation therapy. She was trastuzumab and taxane resistant. And within a month of going on everolimus, had a profound response in this brain metastasis, and within 5 months disappearance. Scientists have discussed the fact that everolimus does appear to cross the blood-brain barrier. And so I actually have developed an investigator-sponsored trial that's evaluating everolimus with lapatinib and capecitabine for refractory HER2-positive brain metastases. There's phase one data showing that lapatinib and everolimus are safe when given together. My study is actually a phase 1-2 because we're going to do a dose escalation and make sure that the triplet combination is safe together. But building off of Nancy Lin's data set of capecitabine and lapatinib, which is interesting and hopeful, but not a home run, we're hoping that targeting not only the intracellular domain of the receptor, but the downstream target, the mTOR, that maybe if we can do that, and if both of those molecules can cross the blood-brain barrier, that we'll have more of an effect on patients suffering with this. It's just a real problem with HER2-positive breast cancer, the issue of brain metastases.
So I'm just kind of curious in terms of how you think this is going to shake out in actual non-protocol management. Where do you think people, assuming it gets approved, or maybe it's already approved for renal cell, where do you think you might be using it, if at all?
It's a good question. I think that I will be using it in the endocrine-resistant disease. In other words, I don't think that in my practice I'm going to be using it up front. I don't think we have any real data to suggest that we should at this point. Beyond that, will I always be using it in combination with exemestane? Will I use it with tamoxifen, as was done in the TAMRAD study, or fulvestrant in some patients? And honestly, I have to say I probably will, because if a patient has progressed on exemestane in the past, then I'm going to pair it with something else, because the data is very interesting and exciting, and there's no reason to think that it wouldn't work with another one of these agents. I think that we need more data in the upfront setting, and I think the next step really is looking at the adjuvant setting and if we can do better in terms of preventing recurrence of disease later on.
Is there an adjuvant trial, incidentally?
There are, again, a number of groups putting forth concepts, everyone vying for a spot, so it's an unanswered question at this point.
You wrote a paper a couple months ago in Cancer Treatment Reviews about a topic of great interest to a lot of people, the issue of progression-free survival as an endpoint in clinical trials. Any comments?
Progression-free survival is a very important thing for patients. Being patient-centered and doing a lot of clinic and seeing a lot of women with metastatic breast cancer, a woman who has control of her disease for a longer period of time in general feels better in terms of peace of mind, feels that she can get back to her day-to-day life more and make plans. When progression occurs, regardless of how the oncologist carefully phrases it to the patient, explaining that this is an expected event in the course of metastatic disease, it is still devastating for a woman. And it's still hard for the oncologist to tell the woman, your disease is growing and this therapy is no longer working. And so I think from a clinically meaningful standpoint and a patient-centered standpoint in terms of quality of life, anecdotally, what I've seen in my own clinic is that it is meaningful and important to look at. Now, that doesn't mean that therapies, in my opinion, should be approved based on a small 3-month improvement in progression-free survival with absolutely no overall survival benefit and toxicity, etc. But all other things being equal, if you're comparing two therapies that have generally the same side effect profile and have similar overall survivals, but the progression-free survival associated one versus the other is better, I go for the one with the longer progression-free survival. The overall survival endpoint is, for certain, a gold standard. However, with crossover and the number of effective therapies available to women with breast cancer, it makes it a harder endpoint to come to. And so I really do feel that in a clinic-based setting, it is something that I use in terms of making treatment decisions with a patient.
So, you know, one key thing you said there is assuming equal side effects tolerability. And, you know, where, of course, as you say, there's been this huge debate relates to bevacizumab. So from your point of view, if you compare, let's say, chemotherapy to chemotherapy plus bevacizumab, my understanding is the FDA in their decision was kind of saying that from their, I guess, judgment point of view, the downside or the risks of therapy, not the cost, but the downside, you know, I don't know, like excess cardiovascular events, et cetera, you know, outweighed the benefit. Do you agree with that assessment?
It is a really sticky issue, and I have to say my heart is torn over bevacizumab. I do feel that there are toxicities that have been underplayed. The hypertension is something that can be difficult in patients. I've had patients with abscesses and non-healing infections, and I even had a bowel perforation. So I appreciate that this is a true drug. It's not a benign monoclonal antibody. And that said, in general, if you look at doublet chemotherapy, for example, gemcitabine, paclitaxel, the toxicity experienced by patients is rather great, and more so than I've seen personally with paclitaxel and bevacizumab. There is this concern, you mentioned cardiotoxicity with bevacizumab, long-term outcome of patients taking bevacizumab, and pooled analyses are now suggesting that there is an impact on the heart, probably especially in patients who've received prior anthracyclines. On the other hand, as I said, it's generally well tolerated. It does appear to improve progression-free survival, not to the extent that was seen in the Miller study. Other studies were not able to recapitulate that 5-month improvement in time to progression, but it did improve progression-free survival. But what breaks my heart about the bevacizumab story is that it's a quote-unquote targeted therapy without a known target. And good scientific work wasn't done prior to developing it to really give us an idea of the patients who would benefit most. For example, I saw a patient with inflammatory breast cancer several years ago and was not HER2 amplified, one of the unusual cases. It was a triple negative inflammatory breast cancer. And she had a really profound response with bevacizumab and paclitaxel. So I think that there are some patients where bevacizumab may be particularly effective, but we don't have a molecular guiding light to tell us which patients are most likely to benefit. Is it triple negative tumors? Is it basal-like tumors? Is it HER2 positive? The Averil data is not very impressive that just came out. We still have the Beth trial to come out to look at that in HER2 positive, but it's still a big unknown. And that's what I think is a shame, because I believe neoangiogenesis is critically important in some tumor types. We're just not sure where to use it.